The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists and contributors, and now our live events are bringing that community even closer.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and join the debates on the big issues of our time. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Is Cameron More Radical Than Thatcher?, was recorded at Conway Hall in February 2015 and was chaired by columnist and broadcaster Steve Richards.
Thank you all very much indeed for coming along this evening. I'm Steve Richards. I'll be chairing the evening. And if it's okay with all of you, this is the way we thought we'd structure it. David Walker and Polly Toynbee will introduce their book for about 15 minutes. I'll then talk to them about that, and then we'll open it up for questions. So hopefully we'll have a good, constructive evening. So without further ado, Polly and David will introduce the thinking and the thoughts behind their book.
Thank you, Steve. Friends, Guardian readers, countrymen, we come to bury Cameron, not to praise him.
There are fewer than 100 days now until the election, so it is time to bring to bear evidence to appraise the Cameron government. And here's the sneak preview. It has been a government of dogma and disarray.
We call it a coup for one reason, because Cameron stood for election on what we regard as a false prospectus. Nothing that he promised before the election resembled anything that he actually did once in power. And some keep saying, well, he's a moderniser. We say, no, he isn't. He hasn't detoxified, he's retoxified the Tories. 13 years after Theresa May first said it, they remain the nasty party. You voted blue, but you didn't get green.
The big society was an ad man's gimmick, PR cover for cuts. Before 2010, Cameron hugged hoodies and huskies. He even promised to match every penny of Labour spending, the same spending he now says caused the crash.
It's a coup because Cameron used the crash and public finances as a pretext for their distinctly proto-Thatcher agenda. Dogmatic commitments have been carefully hidden from the public gaze before the election. But in office, he's gone even further than she ever dared.
It's more than cuts in spending. On the authority last week of the distinguished LSE professor, Sir John Hills, who's been looking in detail at welfare, health and schools policy under Cameron, the verdict is that this has been a remarkably radical government, pursuing distinctly right-wing policies under cover of deficit reduction. Cameron has acted with ideology aforethought.
He's also been remarkably unconservative and ununionist. At a moment when we desperately needed to pull together, he pursued politics of division, division by region, class, generation, and citizen, pitting them all against each other.
Cameron's Coup is a book, you will have gathered, we felt we had to write. In it, we look at what happened on his watch, talking to people around the country, on the streets, in offices, schools, hospitals and factories.
Others write about Westminster politics,
though few as wisely and entertainingly as Steve Richards.
But we've tried to explore the policies and their outcomes.
Let's immediately acknowledge that a lot of people, especially those of a certain age, are doing well, thank you. Some very well indeed. You can see around us here in London. But our interviews uncovered scratchiness, unhappiness, even among the quite affluent, about the deliberate disuniting of the kingdom under Cameron.
For most people, living standards have fallen back or else they've stagnated. And those queuing at food banks may be a minority, but they are totemic. So let's briefly look at the charge sheet, starting with the economy.
Osborne goes into the 2015 election claiming success, but he throttled the growth he inherited. It took three wasted years before GDP started expanding once again. Productivity is abysmal. There's a record trade deficit and no sign of Osborne's promised march of the makers.
Unlike previous recessions, new jobs have been created, but they are mostly low-wage, insecure, zero hours, or self-employed. The underemployed and the overqualified workforce is expanding, and it's teeming with graduates who will never earn enough to pay back their student loans.
Of course, spending and income had to be adjusted after the crash. No one disputes that, even Alexis Tsipras. It's how, over what timetable, and in what relationship to growth. They chose to load the adjustment on government spending. For every £5 of adjustment, £4 is coming from cuts in spending against £1 from increases in taxation. That meant, inevitably, that the burden would be disproportionately carried by the poorest. Inequity was built into the project.
The public, uncertain and afraid, really bought into the message that austerity was the only remedy. To blame, of course, was the Labour-era excess. That was and remains a lie. And I say that on the authority, though he only just got round to saying it recently, of none other than the former Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King.
An oversized state, Osborne kept saying, was crowding out enterprise. This is unevidenced dogma. Robert Choate of the Office for Budget Responsibility noted how cutting government spending correlated depressingly with a slump in private investment. So with Cameron, it's not so much economic orthodoxy from the textbooks. Their political commitments always came first.
But they always had a clear and partisan purpose. Cameron's political genius was to seize the moment in 2010 when cutting the social state could be disguised very successfully as economic necessity.
Cameron isn't an intellectual, doesn't do high flow and political theorising for all his Oxford education. Immersed in the groupthink of his Tory generation, his basic belief is that the state is an impediment. Markets solve all ills, and individualism trumps anything collective.
And all of that, of course, came with a tribal commitment to making sure our people, the city, corporate chieftains, those who partake in country suppers in the Cotswold dinner tables, were all well protected.
And they do have ideologues. Chief Keeper of the Flame is Oliver Letwin, who cut his teeth as special advisor to Sir Keith Joseph, remember him, Thatcher's brains, the man who is most responsible for converting the Tory party to market-fixated neoliberalism.
You may remember that Letwin went on record quite a long time ago saying that his ambition was to cut the state to below a third of GDP.
The aim is to revert to pre-Second World War patterns of welfare. Before, that is, the United Kingdom took Friedrich von Hayek's road to serfdom. Under Cameron, the ambition has been very nearly realised.
Tories say they hate welfare and dependency, and yet they've proved once again how acutely attuned they are to the welfare of their own voters. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has recently shown how most of what was saved in the spending cuts has actually been recycled into tax cuts for the better off.
The cut in income tax rates from 50 to 45% for the very highest earners was hugely symbolic. Now, the fair-minded among you will say, didn't they also raise the threshold for the personal allowance in order to take the lowest earners out of tax? Yes, indeed, they did, and it cost £10 billion, of which £7.5 billion benefited higher-earning households. They're now pledging more cuts in income tax again, destined for the top half of households.
The Liberal Democrats claimed that those tax allowances were their own special contribution to social justice. Clegg still seems to be extraordinarily unaware that raising the level at which we start to pay income tax is of most cash value to higher earners.
And it's hard, therefore, not to conclude Clegg and Co were useful idiots. They provided camouflage. The Tories went further than they would have done if they hadn't had the Liberal Democrats for cover, their assumed reasonableness justifying austerity.
Useful idiots or mere idiots? They voted for Cameron's Health and Social Care Act, now denounced even by such Tories as Stephen Dorrell, who was a former Tory health minister, as the wrong legislation done at the wrong time. The Liberal Democrats style themselves as localists, and yet they've allowed councils to be cut by a third, while Eric Pickles keeps issuing more and more Stalinist instructions. He tells them how often to empty their bins from the centre. Only the other day, he ordered Greenwich Council to stop publishing their borough newsletter.
Now, some of you may have experience of the public sector. Public sector staff were always in Osborne's sights. According to his biographer, he plotted before the election to target people in the public sector because they tended to vote Labour. As a proportion of total employment, the public sector is now down to 17%, with around, to this point, about a million jobs having been lost.
Because those good jobs have largely been replaced by in the private sector by low-paid bad jobs, it's no surprise that the bill for in-work tax credits rose. And it's no surprise either that the housing benefit bill has soared upwards, most of it now being paid to private landlords, who, of course, benefit from soaring rents.
Having decided to cut spending, Cameron targeted the poorest. £12 billion was stripped from benefits in freezes and cuts. The Bank of England, the IMF, the OECD worry about a low-wage economy, not for the sake of social justice, but because low wages mean low skills mean low productivity, and low productivity must mean lower growth. At last week, or the week before, the World Economic Forum, as they modestly call it at Davos, they spoke of little else, though no chief executive actually volunteered to pay themselves less or their staff more.
All it together tends to raise a laugh these days because, of course, it was the poorest who were hardest hit. And often the same families who were hit serially over and over again, compounding the damage done to them. Child poverty is rising again after it had fallen a million under Labour.
Perhaps even worse has been the taunting, the bullying, the harassing of the vulnerable. The bogus distinction made between the hard-working and the rest, and pretending that the spiralling DWP budget is due to idlers when pensions take over half the budget and the unemployed only £1 out of every £33 spent under the whole Social Security budget.
Cameron said we could trust him on the NHS. He said annual NHS spending would rise, and so it has, but only by 0.6% a year. And that's five times less than the average annual increase in the NHS that it's had since 1948. This at a time when the population has been growing and ageing quite fast, and social care has been cut back steeply at the same time.
In such circumstances, the last thing a government that cared, really cared, would have done is set about the NHS with an axe and impose a disastrous reorganisation that's costed nearly £4 billion, which sapped the energy of staff and built in competition and fragmentation instead of joined-up patient care. In many ways, it's surprising how well the NHS has coped, and it's only now we see that it's finally, the problem's finally bursting out in accident and emergency and GP surgeries.
Now, you might by now be saying, well, you know, Guardian journalists write a book calling Cameron right-wing, so much so obvious.
But there's a twist to the tale. What's really surprising is how inept, how chaotic this government has been.
Some of the mayhem, we reckon, has actually been deliberate. Tory ministers admitted that they were engendering creative destruction as a tactic for clearing the ground so markets could extend further into public services.
It's almost deliberate administrative irresponsibility. They dislike the state so much, they don't really bother with accountability or even effectiveness. Michael Gove's the example here. His free schools are beyond anyone's control. Academy chains go unchecked by Ofsted, not even audited. Teachers' professionalism is undermined as a third of academies now hire untrained staff.
Raising university fees to £9,000 was one thing, but they failed to calculate, let alone to model, the likely rate of payback. National Audit Office reckons that more than 65 pence in the pound loaned will have to be written off. Is that cock-up or is it conspiracy? They politicised the police by creating police and crime commissioners, but the elections were a fiasco.
They cut HMRC staff, so taxes owing which some compute to be beyond £40-50 billion couldn't be collected. They let Richard Branson's lawyers run rings round them and regain the West Coast mainline franchise.
And they couldn't even arrange shooting the badgers.
DWP has the worst record. The work programme isn't working. Contractors do less well than Job Centre Plus in getting people into jobs. Universal credit is now years late and looks unlikely ever to work. Food banks replace the social fund.
Cameron can't really be called a conservative, because after all, what are you conserving if you hive off England's canals and waterways and you privatise English heritage? They tried, don't forget, to sell off the Forestry Commission, nation's woodlands. Their own mates, the estate agents, forced them to back down not to sell the land registry. Royal Mail has been sold off at a knockdown price through the same financiers who caused the crash.
Great tranches of national infrastructure has been sold abroad. Nuclear energy is being supplied, if at all, by the French state and, fabulous paradox, the Chinese Communist Party, which now has a major stake in the sewers that run under London streets, owned by Thames Water, part-owned by a Chinese holding company.
Cameron appointed a climate change denier, Owen Paterson, to be his environment secretary, and he encourages his community secretary to veto every application for wind turbines. And that despite all of the flummery before of the election, promising to be the greenest government ever.
The railways, despite carrying more passengers than ever, are shaping up as a disaster area with big prestige projects such as HS2 taking the cash for vital improvements elsewhere.
The armed forces have been cut to a point where, whatever you may think, for better or for worse, we couldn't actually do another Afghanistan.
So, has the plot succeeded? Has Cameron moved the centre of gravity of UK politics rightwards in an anti-state, anti-tax direction?
We think you couldn't really infer that from the polls. Voting intentions are all over the place. But by no means all of UKIP supporters take the Cameron line on most of these things. Many have, it's true, bought into a punitive view about welfare scroungers. And yet Labour has shown that if you take a strong stand, for instance, against the bedroom tax, you can swing opinion around.
The next stage in the project is well marked out. Ahead, if Cameron remains Prime Minister, a staggering additional £48 billion in spending cuts, including £12 billion more from social benefits.
As the election campaign grinds painfully into action, we are already seeing how Cameron gets the support of the newspaper press, shock jock radio, to echo and amplify all of the Tory messages. And it's payback time for setting aside Leveson and siding with the media barons to fight off any effective new press regulation.
As a direct result of government by and for his own kind, Cameron's opened up a deep and probably terminal rift between the nations of the United Kingdom. Another Tory government and Scotland would be gone. Cameron has made the prospect of the UK leaving the European Union frighteningly possible.
Do they envisage becoming an offshore tax haven in the North Sea? You can't even really call them little Englanders when their myopic vision seems only to include the affluent south of the country.
Evidence. George Osborne's father-in-law, former Minister Lord David Howell, spoke for them all when he called the North East desolate. A place, he said, where there's plenty of room for fracking well away from anyone's residence. Anyone like them.
The choice at the election is whether Britain really wants to be governed again by people like them. Thank you.
Polly and David, thank you very much indeed. Well, if it's okay with all of you, I'll ask Polly and David a few questions and then open it up to the hall. I thought I would start. I have a confession to make. I think that if you follow the policy agenda of this government, you can only reach one conclusion, that it's a government of the radical right. And if you follow Polly and David's narrative, you can only reach that conclusion whether you agree or disagree with the radical right agenda. However, there is plenty of other people who think differently. So if I could put their point of view, and there is evidence around. Let's begin with Cameron himself. If he is this figure of the radical right, why is it that in Number 10, lots of his special advisers have left deeply frustrated? They say all he's bothered about is letting the civil service run things smoothly. They complain that there isn't an ideological bone in his body. Now, I accept the policy agenda, as I say, but that is what a lot of people who've actually worked with him day out and day out say.
I think that's right. I think his brilliant camouflage comes just naturally. He is chillaxed, laid back, doesn't have a swivel-eyed look. He doesn't look as sort of adamant as Margaret Thatcher. He seems a reasonable sort, a very recognisable sort of old-fashioned upper-class Tory of a sort you don't expect to be any kind of fanatic. But he comes from that post-Thatcher generation who just instinctively, by gut instinct, have breathed in neoliberalism as the only way. There is no alternative. Of course, it's what they all think. It's what they always thought. You know, markets are always right. The state should always be cut back. We'll always be intrusive. It's not an ideology exactly. It's simply his whole being. He might say, I'm not an ideologist, yet that's all of his instincts are to always push in that direction. I mean, I think it's interesting that his own party has so misunderstood him. So you get all these mad backbenchers, the swivel-eyed ones, and they think, they somehow, because of gay marriage perhaps, they think he's some kind of liberal. They misunderstand him, which is bizarre.
So, the two pieces of evidence. If you're not potentially a backer of extreme policies, why on earth would you appoint Owen Paterson, an out denier of man-made climate change, to be, of all things, Secretary of State for the Environment? Why would you allow, okay, he used to be your boss when you were at Central Office, Andrew Lansley, to perpetrate what even free market neoliberals would say is a rather large re-disorganisation of the health service? I mean, are we to really believe that Cameron sat there in Number 10 and said, I don't really care, I don't really know what Andrew Lansley is up there, up to down the road in Richmond House at the Department of Health, and I am going to allow him to introduce one of the largest in volume pieces of legislation ever introduced in social policy into the House of Commons, and I'm just going to... That seems to me really implausible.
So is he, we'll move on to the sort of policy agenda, but is he then either a brilliant actor who, I mean, with Margaret Thatcher was transparent. In fact, she probably gave an over-impression of what she was up to. Are you saying that he's an actor who brilliantly has masterminded this coup whilst giving the impression of being something else? Has he been brought up on a set of assumptions that, although in your view are on the right and his view are kind of centrist, non-ideological? Or has some of this happened, as I think he claimed with the NHS, without him even knowing about it?
What, again, what kind of Prime Minister couldn't know about...
I think that was his excuse at the time.
And why that's wrong is he was well aware in opposition of the volume of pamphlets being produced by the likes of Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt, who was appointed Culture Secretary and now is Health Secretary, is on the record, and you can get the pamphlet online, writing a pamphlet arguing for the breakup of the NHS. What did he call it? He called it one of the last remaining evidences of Attlee and socialism which should be got away. Are we really to believe that Cameron wasn't aware that his own appointees had this hinterland? No. So
I think Steve's right when you say you know, it's just, he just takes that as being sort of non-political. It's rather like, you know, if you go canvassing, you knock on the door and someone says, I'm non-political, you put them down as a Tory. they believe that common sense is the Tory point of view. And since Thatcher, the Tory point of view has moved further and further to the right. He has just been brought up on breathing in the air of the idea that, well, you know, markets are the only thing there is. I mean, you know, communism has fallen, proved to be a disaster. You know, myths about 1979. And, of course, it's the only way. It's ordinary. Everything else is bizarre, extraordinary and ideological, but we are not.
So how, then, do you explain the broader political dynamic? I mean, Polly, you mentioned it in passing. In the Thatcher era, those who were discontent in the Tory party tended to be on the left. The so-called wets, who felt they were defeated by the right-wing onslaught of Margaret Thatcher and her allies. Here, and you mentioned it briefly, it is the right who are daily discontented with Cameron. Now, is it again that they just haven't realised he is the pioneer of a sort of crusading recalibration of the state, in a way that they have always dreamed of and might take them out of Europe in the way that they have always dreamed of? Or that perhaps we are wrong? Perhaps he is more of a centrist, or else he wouldn't have alienated the right of his party.
Well, I think he thinks he's a centrist in terms of the extraordinarily right-wing spectrum of his party, that his party has moved so far right there really is no... there is no paper wall between them and UKIP at that end of the party. And so all of the sort of UKIP-minded lot of his party see him as being a moderate. It's that things have just moved on to that degree. I mean, I think they are partly... they dislike his upper-classness. A lot of them aren't upper-class, and they distrust it. They don't forgive him for failing to win the election. They think he liked being in with the Lib Dems, which we suggest in the book he probably ended up... I'm sure it's not what he wished to happen. I'm sure he'd have liked to win outright. But I think he realised that that was an opportunity, not to be more liberal or more moderate, but for them to act as a fig leaf for everything he wanted to do.
There is a... sorry, I mean, another part of the answer, and I appreciate... I'm saying this to, you know, one of the great experts in the dynamics of parties in the House of Commons. Europe is such a toxic issue for the Conservative Party that because Cameron couldn't, perhaps didn't want to, because you can be a liberal and be in favour of UK membership of the EU, didn't deliver immediately on that agenda, which, sorry to mix metaphors, had been festering away ever since Thatcher's fall. There are Tory MPs, Steve spends more time with them than I do. You cannot get within breathing distance of them, but you fall under an immediate avalanche of vituperation about Cameron, and it's on the issue of Europe. I'm thinking of Bernard Jenkin, for example, who broadly would support most of what Cameron's... but because Cameron hasn't delivered the referendum, in-out referendum on Europe, that's not enough, and therefore Cameron gets branded as something he isn't.
One of the interesting issues that you kind of think about as you read the book is why Labour hasn't framed a more effective alternative and critique of the agenda as you've described it. And clearly one of the reasons, again this goes back to Cameron, who once described himself as heir to Blair, is that at times you are struck by a degree of continuity with the Blairite period. I was thinking of your assessment of the NHS reforms. Whenever this comes up, they just reply, well, we're bringing in the private sector by another 1%. Labour brought it in by about 5%. Do you think this is an issue which hinders Labour's critique now?
I think
we were going we took a vow that we would focus on the iniquities of the Cameron government rather than related.
I'm happy to answer that. I mean, I think that's true. I think Labour feels stymied in a lot of directions. I think it feels very torn, as you've often written about very well. between those who say your mistake is, you know, the Blairites who say your mistake is you're not centrist enough, you're not sticking to the Blairite play sheet, playbook, and on the other side, if only you would go more bold, more Syriza, more green, you would capture people's imagination. As it is, nobody's much interested in anything you've got to say because it all sounds fudgy and mumbly, and they're torn between those two instincts, and sometimes go one way and sometimes the other, so you have quite an austerity package on the one hand in public, though actually when you unwrap it, the future plans are Cameron will, in a future government, will cut by 48 billion, Labour would cut by 7 billion. That's a big difference, but the rhetoric hasn't been very different because Labour doesn't really know whether they want to admit that it's that different. I mean, on the NHS and privatisation, yes, Labour opened the door to a certain amount of cold surgery units run by the private sector, but it was quite small what they did. And, you know, Alan Milburn himself, although last week behaving disgracefully, when I spoke to him about a year ago and quoted him, said, but this is not what we intended. This is not it, and regarded the Tory Act as a disaster. But they are terribly torn internally, and some of those Blairites just... Après moi le déluge, they just can't quite bear that Ed Miliband should win because they're still stuck back in the glory days.
You said you wanted to focus, David, on the iniquities.
Metaphor.
Sorry?
What? No.
Right. I was watching Sky today. I don't know if any of you saw it. Sky News did a sort of Q&A with all the leaders. And when they did Clegg, he listed a whole range of things in which he argued he had acted as a constraint, or more than that, on Cameron, the pupil premium for poorer pupils that you mentioned, the tax relief, albeit costing billions and billions of pounds and many others benefiting from it, the constrained caps on education and health and these things. Now, is there anything in that, as far as you can see, given the gloomy economic context in 2010?
Elsewhere in Europe, they do coalition as a matter of course, and Germany is a good example. In Germany, when the latest Merkel coalition came to power 2 years ago, the SDP and the Christian Democrats signed a coalition agreement which spelt out two things. One, a programme that they could jointly back, and second, a protocol for how they would behave in office. I, for the life of me, cannot accept a Liberal Democrat explanation for what's happened because they did sign a coalition agreement. If it was in the coalition agreement, the Liberal Democrats signed up for it. If it's happened and it wasn't in the coalition agreement, that breaches the agreement. And in any normal coalition, that would have been the occasion of some formal sundering, with Clegg going to the nation saying, here is the agreement, and it's been breached by Cameron. That hasn't happened. So we have to conclude that if policies have been enacted, they were enacted because they were willed, initially at least, by the Liberal Democrats.
And they certainly had the chance on the health, because they almost... I mean, the passage of the Lansley Bill reached a state of such crisis that Cameron himself thought that he was going to lose it. They had a pause in the middle of legislation, which is something I think that had never been done before. And at that, and the Liberals had their, the Dems had their spring conference. Cameron thought at that point they would vote against it, would all be over, and was amazed when Shirley Williams changed her mind, swung round that conference, and the Lib Dems decided to back it with a few very minor changes, nothing very significant. And I think that was a point at which you really realised that the Lib Dems didn't understand their position of power. I suppose on their side, looking back, supposing Cameron doesn't win again next time and we get some sort of Labour-led government, we will look back and say the one thing they did is that they stopped him having an in-out referendum. He would probably have been pushed to have it if they hadn't been there. And that will seem something quite big if we end up not having that referendum.
Did anything when you wrote this book surprise you as you looked into all the policy detail? I've got the reading your books on the Labour period, I think there was a sort of, it's quite interesting, measuring a growing sense of disappointment as you analyse the policy development over 13 years. With this, obviously, you started from a premise. You were both hostile to the coalition in 2010. Did that? Were you merely confirmed when you analysed all the policy? And I know you travelled around the country and so on. Or were you surprised at any point by anything that you discovered in your research for the book?
I'll give two brief examples. I mean, one actually comes from a department where you do have a Liberal Democrat as Secretary of State, and that's energy. I mean, you know, we're, say, Steve says, we're sort of anoraks in terms of policy and spend a lot of time sort of trying to understand what are often, you know, quite complicated structures, trying to actually get to grips with the way they inherited pretty complex, but a series of fairly, also some quite clear commitments from Labour in terms of climate change and the energy balance. They tore that up, and what they've put in place is a dog's breakfast, an apology to canines in saying that. It is a mess of stupendous proportions. But actually trying to understand the nature of energy policy is very difficult. The other one, briefly, we've had quite a lot of conversation in recent years about trying to bring more evidence to bear before public policies are put into effect. And in principle, that must be a good thing. Look at schools. Michael Gove's academies and free schools are almost comprehensively unevidenced. He had a couple of trips to Sweden, and he had some trips to his friends in the United States of America, where they have things called charter schools. Very different animals, actually. Likewise, the free schools in Sweden. And he said, I've seen the future, and the future works. I don't need to model this. I don't need to trial it. I don't need to actually roll it out on the basis of evidence and analysis. And I think I have been profoundly shocked by how our system allowed a dogmatic Secretary of State to just move ahead with a massive change in not just the educational balance, but the constitutional balance, because he has effectively killed, maybe forever, the role of elected local authorities in the provision of schooling in England.
I think it's about the system is interesting, that I think the more we looked at how radical the upheavals have been in health, education, and a whole lot of other fields, is how the system caved in. How little opposition there was, how few people ever said, no, Minister, this is going to be a disaster. Even when real disasters were coming up to hit them, there was a sort of acquiescence on the part of permanent secretaries and others, and they would roll their eyes in private and say it's a disaster, but absolutely didn't stop it when they should have done and could have done. And I think there is a sort of institutional feebleness. I mean, it's within the health service all the way through. Senior people in the health service running hospitals all said disaster, but dared not say it in public.
Have you got a sense, because you go through almost on a sort of departmental basis the policy agenda. Now, obviously, you disapprove of their proposed spending cuts if they were to win. But have you got a sense of what the state would look like? I mean, would some government departments have to go all together? Have you got any, as you were researching this, did you have a sense of how they were planning for the next term in terms of the spending implications translation?
Just one example. You may have seen in the papers recently the announcement by Francis Maude, the Cabinet Office Minister, that he's standing down. He certainly has been involved in drafting policy papers that look at the possible dimensions of government if they were to win again. And they certainly involve the end of at least half a dozen of the principal departments of state, communities and local government, culture, media and sport, probably energy and environment. These departments would actually disappear because government would have shrunk, and reasonable argument, you would not need to have Whitehall departments in these areas because there basically wouldn't be much happening. So you would have a major re-engineering of the centre of government to go along with the reduction in public services. The other brief example, local government. I mean, a local government has already taken, some might say, a disproportionate share of the cuts, with a third of local government spending in real terms cut between 2010 and 2015. That programme of cuts would roll on, and you may already have sort of heard council leaders whispering to one another about merger. There is some councils are already pretty much unviable. And so it's part of the reason why in the conurbations, councils are talking about merger. They cannot exist by them. And so the landscape of our local government would, in the next period of time, change dramatically.
And I think what's alarming is that I very much doubt whether they've really modelled it themselves. I doubt whether Osborne has actually worked out what it really means to cut each department to the bone to that degree, particularly if they are pledging to keep 2% spending defence, protecting schools, as they're saying, as well as protecting health. I think what it leaves for the others is so horrendous that they've flinched and not really looked at it.
And just sorry, very briefly, an example came up the other day. The United Kingdom has a very, very long maritime border. You know, we have a set of islands. Already, there are no patrol aircraft that can cover the maritime border of the United Kingdom. There have been a number of incursions recently by Russian jets and bombers, which have been turning off their transponders, and so you don't know if they're there. We simply do not have patrol aircraft to cover the borders. Now, if you believe in the specific intentions of Vladimir Putin, that's no problem. If you have some suspicion that Putin isn't altogether Pacific, there's a big, big issue. And a big, big issue you might think for a Tory party, which once upon a time was the party of defence.
Could I finally ask you, and then we can open it up with plenty of time for questions. Why, again, if this thesis is right, we've talked about the reaction of the Tory party, some of the problems Labour have had in coming to terms with it, but why there hasn't been more anger across the country? After 2 years of Margaret Thatcher, there were riots in different cities, London, Bristol, and so on. I think we all three of us in different ways covered the poll tax riots in the late 1980s, which included places like Kent. There hasn't been that tangible feel of anger. Now, if you're right about the degree to which a kind of coup has taken place, why not?
I think that's been inexplicable in some ways, and extraordinarily successful they've been in persuading people there is no alternative, the world is in crisis. I mean, they have not let a good crisis go to waste. you know, Osborne started off by pointing at Greece and saying, we are like Greece, we have to tighten our belt, disaster will follow. Labour was away with, for 4 insane months, choosing its leader, and took its eye off the ball. By the time they came back, it was too late. It was absolutely cemented fact that there was nothing we could do but to cut, cut, cut again. We all had to tighten our belt, all in it together, and Labour was to blame. So there was no alternative narrative, and Labour has had real trouble putting up one. As a result, people have been they're angry, they're looking for other people to vote for, they're not happy. Nothing about the polls suggests any kind of contentment. They're very well aware that their own pockets have been hit hard. And now, for the first time, only now, polls are showing they actually don't think we need any more austerity. They think enough is enough. Can Labour capitalise on that? We don't know. But people are starting not to believe the story anymore.
But I think there is, again, briefly, a more prosaic answer to your question. And that is that unlike the 1980s, employment has remained buoyant, and it's a deep, deep problem which economists and experts haven't really fathomed. But it's certainly the case that even as the crash and recession were having the maximum impact, they didn't produce the kind of level of unemployment that we saw in 1981 when there were riots on the streets of Brixton, Liverpool, and so on. However, the jobs to which people have gone are very low-wage, part-time, zero-hours jobs, but they are employed. And despite what Ian Duncan Smith believes, despite what Tory ministers say, most people derive a large portion of their sense of well-being from being in employment, even in low-wage employment. And I think because of that, because jobs are still there, people have kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, it's bad, it may be getting worse in terms of my household income, but at least I'm able to leave the house each day to do a job.
Okay, thank you very much for some opening remarks. Let's now open it up for a wider discussion. Can the lights go up a bit more so we can see the audience? Don't worry. Okay. Right, I can just about see everyone if I do it like this. What, if it's okay with you, I'm going to take... There are already lots of hands up, so I'm going to take three at a time. If you keep your questions short as possible, then we can get as many in. We've got mics. The guy in the second row, and then the guy at the side, and then we'll go to the other side.
Thanks. Do you want us to stand up or just sit down?
Sorry.
Okay. One thing that came up earlier was, is Cameron really a neoliberal, or is he more chillaxed? And it seems to me, and I wondered what you thought about this, that in a sense, whatever he believes himself, and he may believe it, he knows that if he is to lead the Tory party from 2005 until now, and for however much longer, this is the only way to do it. He can't be what he was before the election, because it's a right-wing party. So I think there's an aspect of that. Would you comment on that, please?
Yeah, the party management issue of any leadership. Yeah, there in the corner, then we'll go to this side. Yeah, right next. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. You've mentioned quite a lot of the damage that this government's done, but what doesn't seem to get publicity is the erosion of workers' rights that has been happening, with the worst being the introduction of fees for claims going to employment tribunals, which Vince Cable has personally led that charge. What it's meant is that the claims now have dropped by 80% because if you have an unfair dismissal and you want to go to an employment tribunal, or you've got a discrimination case, you have to put up front £1,250 and hope that the employer doesn't go for costs as well.
Okay, and thank you.
My worry is that if the employment tribunals are running now at 20%, that if this government's re-elected, it will be the end of employment tribunals and rights for employees.
Thanks very much indeed. From this side of the hall, there's a hand towards the back, if you could run up there with the mic. Thank you.
One of the achievements, if that's the right word, of the Thatcher government, both when she was Secretary of State for Education and Prime Minister, was a big development of nursery education for 3- and 4-year-olds. That has been extended by the present government to the sense that there is now rather more nursery education for 2-year-olds, while that for 3- and 4-year-olds has been retained. Is that what the speakers mean by saying Cameron is more radical than Thatcher?
Right. OK, we've got two specific policy questions there and one about party management. Who feels best qualified on the cost of...
Nurseries.
Of the nurseries.
Yes, okay. Nurseries wasn't Thatcher at all. That was entirely a Labour policy, guaranteed 3- and 4-year-old education. There was a small voucher system. It didn't really come in until Gillian Shepherd was John Major's education secretary, and she tried a kind of voucher system for nursery education. But that was one of Labour's great big achievements, guaranteed 3- and 4-year-olds. They have kept it. That's very good. They are extending. I mean, Gordon Brown had announced, but hadn't yet done it, that there would be extension for deprived 2-year-olds. They've done it, and they've extended it, I think, to something like 40%. There's a problem in that there aren't nearly enough places and that it's provided at such a low rate of subsidy that lots of nurseries can't actually provide it, but totally the right thing to be doing in the right direction. That's true. Unfortunately, sure starts, there were 3,500, over 600 sure starts, which really were, you know, anybody who was interested in catching families with problems early, it was the crucial policy. 600 of them have closed. A lot of the others have merged or have had their professionals stripped out of them. It's been a very sorry tale. But you're right, you know, nurseries have kept going, and that's a good thing. I'll just do the other policy.
The other one on
about
the
legal
cost
aid.
Of
yes, about tribunals. You're absolutely right. It's shocking. The trouble is they're quite clever at finding things you can cut that very few people will notice, because at any one time, very few people need access to employment tribunals. And when they suddenly find it's not there or it's impossible, That is a disaster. And of course, gradually it filters through to employers' attitudes to how they can treat their employees, because they know there's no jeopardy for them. They're not going to be hauled in front of employment tribunals. And a lot of those are women harassment, being sacked for pregnancy, those sorts of cases. And I'm sure that's going to make things much worse.
OK, David, what about this dynamic between party and leader? Because it is an interesting point, this one, that leaders are not free to act as they wish. Quite a lot of the time in British politics, parties dictate what a leader can do. And that surely is a factor in making a judgment on the policy agenda and on Cameron's political personality.
Absolutely. I mean, we know we'd be the last people to say that normal politics have been suspended. I doubt not that at the moment there are scholars who are analysing patterns of voting in the House of Commons since 2010, and they may well conclude, as they did when they looked at Blair government, there's a heck of a lot of rebellion around on the back benches. Some of it ideological, some of it sheer bloody-mindedness, because some MPs have little else to do with their time, it seems, than to plot and to scheme against the leaders, sometimes for good reason. The question we keep asking is, what's the outcome in terms of the impact of a government on us, on the country, on people? And looking at the record of the government, these MPs, when it comes to it, have voted for laws in social security, in health, in education, in fiscal reduction, for which the evidence stands. So, in a sense, my rejoinder is, there is always machinations, but the machinations don't diminish the impact of the law, the changes, the cuts that get made at the end of the day.
I suppose in trying, to follow that question again, probably briefly, then we'll have some more questions, is there a possibility that the Cameron who presented himself when he became leader in 2005, when he used to quote approvingly your columns in various speeches and things, is there any chance that was an authentic voice that has had to change because his party wouldn't accept it? Or was that, in your view, an utterly inauthentic, contrived endorsement of your columns by the then leader of the opposition?
I didn't believe it at the time, but I didn't realise quite how duplicitous it was. I didn't think that... I wouldn't have expected him to go to switch to such a dramatic degree once he came into power. He seemed to me like a more conventional sort of conservative. I think at that point he had Steve Hilton behind him, who was very, very clever at pitching things. And the idea was to look quite different, to look quite modern, which he did. The speech which won him the leadership was remarkable, and his whole idea of how the Conservative Party might move forward, become something quite different, become in some ways perhaps slightly more like some Conservative parties on the continent. There was a sort of real breath of fresh air about it, where you thought, yes, this might really work, this might really be moving on. And it's true, as you were suggesting, that he was hugely dragged back by the fact that all of the new intake each time in this, shrinking little party who select more and more right-wing, more and more Euro-rabid candidates. The class of entrants of 2010 were more right-wing, young, dynamic, and more right-wing than ever before. The older ones tend to be more moderate these days. But he's gone on promoting the hardliners, and in his last reshuffle, out went the last of the more moderate. I mean, Damian Green, one of the last of the pro-Europeans, and Ken Clark, and Dominic Grieve, who had been holding on to the Human Rights Act, he went. So the moderating influences he fired, and I don't think he had to do that. No.
The obvious rejoinder, though, is a leader is meant at least occasionally to exhibit some of the lineaments of leadership. I'll give you an example. Now, we know that there have been and before that, no Conservative MPs in Scotland. On Cameron's watch, Scotland started rumbling. the election of an SNP majority administration at Holyrood in 2011 surely would have set alarm bells ringing in the head of a United Kingdom Prime Minister, even a Prime Minister who didn't have any MPs in Scotland. The fact that Cameron let it ride, was unaware, didn't care enough about what was happening in Scotland to try and nip in the bud the movement that then became the nearly successful SNP bid to sunder the United Kingdom. That says something, I think, about the narrowness of Cameron's vision. You know, a leader has to be more than the captive of his or her party. He has to, and I think there's very little evidence that Cameron's gone beyond that.
I'd like to know your view, though, because, I mean, you've been a very close observer. What do you make of that extraordinary transformation?
I don't think it's as big a transformation. It's a big tonal transformation. But if you read carefully about what he said about the big society and so on, and that famous early phrase, there is such a thing as society, it's not the same as the state, it was actually an echo, a very clever reworking of the Thatcher quote about there being no such thing as society. Because what they both meant was that charities and other intermediary bodies could replace elements of the state. So I think from very early on, he was a small state conservative, not a Macmillan one nation conservative. But he had a vision of trying to bring with that a range of new agencies to deliver public services, to soften that vision. But certainly by the election of 2010, all the charities were telling me they were being told that all their budgets were being cut. So even in practical terms, before power, he wasn't delivering on that. But I thought their claim to be a progressive, new, one nation kind of conservative leadership was actually a very clever reworking of Thatcherism. So I'm not at all surprised by the way he's developed, but that's my view. I see more continuity than change. But let's get some more questions. Yeah, the lady at the side there, the mic's coming towards you. Thanks very much.
Hello. 1st of February marked the biggest change to the criminal justice system in terms of probation services, privatisation, two-thirds have been sourced out to 21 different contract areas. And I've just been absolutely astounded that Grayling has made so many errors. We've had the crisis in the prisons, the book ban. We had a trial centred around mackerel and dumplings. There's been the legal aid system, the embarrassment conflict of interest that led to the HMI inspector resigning today, I believe, I think it was today or yesterday, of probation. And how has Cameron, you know, he hasn't had any view on this. How has this been allowed to happen? It's just been quite astounding.
Great.
And in
Thanks.
Terms of the public, there's been an out-and-out apathy and a lack of airtime, but BBC Breakfast did manage to publicly talk about it on Sunday, and up until now, they haven't been interested.
Thank you very much. Is there a microphone up there in the balcony? Because I'm conscious that there's probably someone there who'd like to ask a question. Yeah, okay, thanks.
First of all, thank you for a brilliant array of facts and ideas and arguments. There's just one word, one phenomenon that I'd like to add, and that's the word lawless, the lawless state, lawlessness. In the same way as the civil service, you say, doesn't follow procedures because they don't seem to have any administrative law, there is a research shows that if you're a worker, you don't get paid, you have no redress, that employers are really behaving in a lawless way. Equally, they can, you can be served rotten food, your environment can be poisoned at work, and redress for that, that's becoming lawless. I think we can't get justice either, because an or average person can't have access to the law.
Okay.
To get redress. So
thank you.
I think that's a powerful word, to say we've become a lawless state.
Okay, thank you. Two related questions there, I think. Somebody on this side. Okay, at the front here, as a mic is very near, and then we'll have time for another set.
Thank you. Why do you think Labour have been so ineffectual in trumpeting their own really good record in office and allowed the lie to be perpetrated again and again that Gordon Brown was almost single-handedly responsible for the big crash and not pointed out that actually at the time the Conservatives were urging an even lighter touch to the economy?
Interesting question. Would you like to... either of you or both of you focus on the two policy-related questions on or various aspects of legal...
Well, you do the Union Labour, I'll just say a brief word. Right. I mean, in any way, Grayling's record at Justice, remembering he did try to do similar things while he was still at work in pensions, is a classic example of dogma and disarray. The dogma, you gave the example of a rushed... ill-thought-out contractorisation of the probation service. It'll end in disaster. There will be high-profile cases where offenders are not properly supervised. That's bound to happen, not least because the contracts have been let to the likes of Capita, not Serco, I think they didn't bid, but G4S. G4S and Serco, on this government's watch, were found guilty of major breaches of their contract and some suspicion as yet unresolved because it's investigated by the police, possible breaches of the criminal law as well. Grayling was allowed to go ahead in exactly the same way as Andrew Lansley, as if the Prime Minister, either, as you perhaps intimated, wasn't aware, or actually deliberately wants this to happen but doesn't want to immerse himself in the detail. But it's also disarray because you gave the evidence, gave the example of the book ban. What kind of system do we have where a minister... a Secretary of State can reach down into the detail of the administration of our prisons and pronounce an edict that says prisoners shall not receive parcels which contain these dreadfully dangerous thing called books. Now, it didn't work. He's had to withdraw the edict and so on. But we sort of alluded to earlier, what puzzled us more than anything about examples like that was why the system has so few checks and balances. But then we recollect, when Michael Howard, back in the major government, was he wasn't Justice Secretary, he was Home Secretary, and prisons were part of his empire, he sacked the man who headed the autonomous prisons agency because he dared to say to Howard, I don't think your policy for prisons is going to work. So there is a bit of form, I think, in the Tories' approach to prisons. But actually... to be not fair, but it's worth observing that Grayling did a bad deal with the Treasury. He has to make large-scale savings in the Justice Department's budget. He cannot afford the number of prison places that the Tories' own approach to criminal justice would deliver. So he's a man caught between a rock and a hard place, which in no way justifies his very costly attack on the probation service.
I mean, again, you might expect there to be prison riots, but it hasn't quite happened as yet. But you feel that the pressure cooker is there. And on the Labour question, I think, again, the thing this government is really, really good at is a certain kind of attack. And they have been forensic, you know, this does help if you've got 80% of that press behind you to support you with that. I mean, our book, The Verdict, about Labour's 13 years, we go through their social policy and give them very good marks for that, not for everything. I've already mentioned the sure starts, which were terrific. I mean, they needed a lot more done, but it was just at the beginning of a programme. Now being badly curtailed. You look at their neighbourhood renewal programmes, not much celebrated. Unless you lived on council estates, you wouldn't know that that had worked very well. 90% of homes brought up to decent home standards, and a lot of those estates had been semi-derelict. You look at health, highest approval rates ever. I never thought you could abolish waiting lists. They did. I thought waiting lists were the natural part of the rationing system of the NHS. They did that. True, they put in a lot of money, but they did. And yet somehow this government has managed to turn it around. Labour, NHS, mid-staffs. They just do this every time. They manage to find a bad example, a case, or Wales. They go on a lot about Wales, the Welsh health system. And Wales, you know, they've decided to spend a bit less on their health and more on their social care. Some of their, you know, some of their patterns of health have less good results, but it's not clear that it's to do with policy, but maybe to do with the nature of their population, older and so on. But you go back through Labour and you think, yes, why are they not trumpeting it? And I've written that quite often. John Hills's research on the Labour years gives them very good marks on this. And I do think we have to remember that and talk it up. And the idea that, you know, an awful lot of Labour supporters all say, well, they didn't really do much, did they? Not much difference between them. Actually, there was a hell of a lot of difference, and they did do a lot. And we should talk about it more. You know, if we're trying to persuade people to vote Labour, there were very good reasons why they got a lot of things right.
OK, thank you very much. Let's get another three questions in. Let's go to the front here. Over here. OK, let's do the front first then. Thank you.
I just wondered whether you thought that the reason they've been able to... they've kind of filled the vacuum where the last government had the opportunity to not do things quietly. There were a lot of really good things that were done, but they didn't try and win the argument. Whereas maybe Cameron and Osborne have just filled that void. And again, Thatcher was very good at it as well. You have to say that she had an argument and she went for it, but the Labour Party was always almost embarrassed of what it was doing.
That's a good question. On this side, thanks.
Fine. I just wanted to bring you up on something you said in your opening duologue about the railways. Now, the railways are, I think, a convenient punching bag for everyone because there is always something that's gone wrong somewhere. But and I won't pretend that the Tory government has been particularly good for the railways, but to say that there aren't major upgrades taking place is completely wrong, and to say that High Speed 2 is just a prestige project is similarly wrong. The railway between London and Rugby is the busiest mixed traffic railway in all of Europe, and frankly, there is not enough space to put more trains on it. Now, idea of High Speed 2 is to allow more people to travel to the north, from the north to the south. But the problem is you can't put those on the current main lines. And also, why is it high speed? Because it's a modern railway.
Okay.
If you're going to build it, it's going to be built new.
All right. Credit for that big capital spending project. One more. There's a person here. Thanks.
Good evening. I actually come from South Lincolnshire, and I've been involved in an independent movement which seems to be gaining a lot of strength, and it's definitely gaining a lot of strength in local government, and I know for sure that the independents are going to be putting forward a lot of candidates for the parliamentary elections. Do you think, what's your opinion, do you think the independents could play a strong role if we manage to get a lot of parliamentary candidates in a fairer government?
Okay, thank you. When you say independent of all the other smaller parties that you stand, just says independent next to the...
Yeah, candidate. Well, it's actually, there's one particular group, Lincolnshire Independents, and they've been doing very well in local government because they believe firmly in standing up for what is right for the local people.
Okay, that's great.
There's a lot of interest from...
Thank you. Huge issues to explore. Let's begin with this one about language, yes, and confidence of argument.
Absolutely right. And that's something that we actually said in our analysis of Labour a lot. They did good by stealth, which is great that you get lots of things done. But Blair and Brown, both of them, were very unsure whether to say, look, we've got these terrific social programmes going, because they're mostly for people in the bottom half of the population. They're not people in the top half of the population. Are you sure that taxpayers are really happy to see their money going on these programmes? They're happy to talk about schools and health, but all of the other stuff, council housing, you know, repairing council housing or sure starts and things, they were much less certain. And as a result, exactly as you say, the idea wasn't imprinted on people's minds that tax is well spent, that these things are for the good of the country, that by looking after families in trouble at a very young age, you stop problems much further down the line. Anyone who works in any field always says, prevention, why aren't we getting to prevention? And Labour was beginning to do that, but it never really stuck because they weren't sure. I mean, rather in the same way that they never really talked about Europe. Blair, in all of those years, never made one speech about Europe except in Europe. He never made a speech in this country about it. again, he felt passionately about it, but there was always that uncertainty. I think Labour always lacks the self-confidence because they're under constant assault. You know, you sit there in Downing Street and you see those, you know, you see the Sun and the Express and the Mail and the Times and the Telegraph all gunning at you. And it makes you much more nervous. And I always say to audiences, perhaps largely Guardian readers, maybe not altogether, sometimes it's a good idea to take your Daily Mail out of the bin and have a look at it from time to time and to understand what it is that makes Labour politicians sometimes seem cowardly and afraid.
David, what about on the policy issue of, you know, capital? I know you're not a supporter of the high-speed rail project, but it's a sign, isn't it, of a willingness of this government to invest, to spend quite a lot of money on capital projects.
Well, no, it hasn't, actually. I mean, the government inherited from Labour in its last days a plan to try and keep the momentum after the crash going by a large programme of investment, private, public sector, a lot of it in the public sector. That was torn up by the incoming government. 2 years later, we had the National Infrastructure Plan. So we could have a debate about the merits of HS2 or indeed HS3 or Crossrail 2. The point is, you can only really have a sensible discussion about an individual project if it's part of a wider strategy, not just for transport, but for the urban and economic future of the country, both here in London and South East, in Northwest around Manchester, and so on and so forth. And you can only do that if, I think, you have a conception of government as a potential force for good. Government doesn't have to do everything. Government doesn't have to build everything. But only government can actually get a wider sense of the shape of the country as we move forward and the way in which you might need to move resources around to match available economic opportunity. I'll just give you an example. You could say, yeah, we need HS2, but we also need, if you lived in Newcastle, you might well say, we also need to dual the A1, which runs from Newcastle to Edinburgh, a main artery of the country, large sections of which are a two-lane road. They're not dual carriageway. Now, you make that choice if you have a conception of the wider needs of the North East. If you believe the North East deserves the backing of central government in order to push its development forward, if you disbelieve, you don't believe with David Howell that the North East is the place where other people live and you can safely frack in their backyards. So my point is, you need a strategy, and it's a strategy that's genuinely rooted in a belief that those areas of the country which may have suffered deindustrialisation, which may need support, should be supported. So you put HS2 in a proper context. And by the way, how can we be building HS2 when we haven't really resolved the question of whether London's major airport should be Heathrow or Gatwick? There are critical questions here. And again, the premise has to be a belief that government has a major role to play in shaping the wider picture in which individual projects go.
And finally, Pauline, independence and proliferation of all the independent ambits.
I mean, there have always been quite a few around in sort of batches. There are certain areas of the country where local government has a tradition of having quite a lot of independence. And it kind of works if it's a small enough unit. People actually know who they are. They know that person. They trust that person. They know the sorts of local interests. Maybe that's true in South Lincolnshire. They know the sorts of interests they've got, so they know what they're voting for. When it comes to a general election, where most people can't name who their local MP is, where people are, you know, feel very remote from what happens at Westminster, you actually, I think, need parties. I don't mean to say that you need them fixed as they are now, but you need parties with badges, with manifestos, that tells you that if you vote for X, who you don't really know who they are, broadly belongs to that alliance that's called a party. I don't see how you can run a democracy without it. I don't see how it's not chaotic and shambolic if you vote for an independent who might do anything within any range of policies. I mean, I'm passionately in favour of proportional representation, and I think this election may be the one that busts our present first-past-the-post system, because it will be outrageous if lots of people have voted for parties that will have very little representation but an awful lot of votes. I mean, I've been there. I've seen that, done it. My shameful past in the SDP, we got within 2% of Labour and virtually no seats. And it just will be wrong. And I think the moment that you set that free, you make it possible for people to start up a new party that could break through the sort of 2.5 party hegemony we have now, there'll be less sense that you need independence and more sense that, you know what, I could set up another party, I could break through.
Great. We've got time for another round, one final round. The hand up there, sort of, the mic is coming to you now, I think. Yeah, no, the one back there as you were, where you were.
Thank you. My question is, everything you've said about Cameron, you know, is he a bumbling idiot and just sort of, you know, or is he really clever and fooling us somehow? But the reality is the Tories haven't sealed the deal with the electorate. They are still behind in the polls. So how effective have they really... I mean, they may have been radical, much more radical than obviously most of us probably in this room would like, but have they been as effective as all that? Is he as clever as all that? Because they haven't really got very far in gaining more support, if anything, support's slipping away from them.
OK, thank you. Somebody from this side? Could you pass the mic? Yeah, that in the same row sort of thing, I think, just for speed purposes, really. Thanks.
OK. How much do you think that Cameron's attack on public services is an attack on their workforce in the public services as much as their recipients? Just in the same way as Thatcher's attack on their nationalised industries was attack on the trade unions, that if public services are sold off to social enterprises and to Virgin, those workforces then become less politicised.
OK, thank you. And one more, someone near the... have you got someone near... Yeah, perfect, thank you.
To what extent do you think the Iraq war has damaged Labour's confidence in coming out and being proud of the party that they are? And how do you think the Tories have exploited that? And what do you think Labour can do about it?
OK, good questions, thank you. Let's, if we can, begin with this. It is interesting, isn't it, that, you know, I remember even during those whole sort of Blair landslides, whenever you got a group of people together on the so-called left of centre, they all say how terrible it is, how formidable the right are, and so on. And as that questioner suggests, I mean, you'd be saying they've got all the language, Labour can't frame the arguments. But the polls suggest that throughout this period that you've chronicled, they haven't sealed the deal. So what's...
Well, they haven't. They haven't. You're absolutely right. One has to keep remembering this, that even as Labour slipped back a bit, it's still, you know, predicted to be well ahead in seats. There's no sense of strong affection or liking for Cameron or this government. Very little. And the Conservative Party is, a shrinking entity. There is huge discontent with all of the parties. And... I think it's, we keep saying the hardest possible election to call. If they do pull it off and manage to inch one seat ahead, I don't think it'll be any better than that. I mean, I'm not expecting that to happen. I think that Labour will inch ahead. But if they were to, there is a danger that it goes down in history as being, another great victory for them, which it certainly won't be. And I think that Labour's very easily unnerved, for all the reasons we were talking about before, really, and is for it quite often when they should, strengthen their spines and just be braver, hit back more often, be quicker off the mark. I mean, with the thing about boots yesterday... took them half the day to say, what do we do? Boots has attacked us. And they all ring each other up, panic, and I was ringing up saying, what are you going to do? Well, we're going to say something soon. It's halfway around all over the place. And finally they come out and say, yes, the man lives in Monaco, his company doesn't pay any taxes, it's a disgrace. But, they don't quite dare say what they feel in their gut instantly, and they should do much more of that. It would make them sound more authentic. It would make them you know, sound like people who just stood up there and said, I'm not going to put up with this. It's wrong.
But, I mean, it's worth, without sounding conspiratorial, to remember that political parties aren't just the foot soldiers and the people out there. They are also the people who donate money. And Paul has just mentioned hedge fund-owned company Boots. When was it? Last year or the year before, the Conservatives held a fundraising dinner at the Hurlingham Club in Chelsea, to which large numbers of very well-endowed corporate barons came, including a number of Russians, and they, at this dinner, raised large sums of money to back the Tory enterprise. So the Tories, even if they can't mobilise people on the streets, will nonetheless be able to mass mail and to provide advertising because there are large amounts of money available for their campaign. So one thing I think we have to recognise that Cameron has done is seal the deal with a section, maybe a large section, of the corporate class of the United Kingdom, who, rightly or wrongly, feel their interests, and often their pocketbook interests in terms of personal taxation, are better served by a Tory government. And I think that relationship between money and political power has become much more transparent, not through anything the government's done in recent times. So he may not have sealed the deal with the people, but he certainly sealed a version of the deal with plutocracy.
Could I ask you, David, to focus on the question about public service reform first, because you quoted George Osborne earlier as saying one of the reasons he was taking on the public sector was because that was where a large section of the Labour vote lay. So that would presumably reinforce the questioner's view. I suppose the alternative is, I'm sure they would all say, we might disagree with how they're going about it, that they are trying to reform public services to improve the experience for patients, pupils. I'm sure they would say that was their motive, not
well, except reform of the employees. Amounts to getting rid of public provision. Now, you could say it doesn't matter who provides as long as the provision is excellent, but it does matter. It matters deeply that the people providing schooling, people working in a hospital, a GP surgery, have some sense of an obligation to the public interest. If you are employed, and I don't want to, you know, diss people who work for private companies, but if you're employed by Circle, if you're employed by Virgin, if you're employed by Capita, your prime purpose in life is to maximise the profitability of those companies. That's why they exist. And your colleague mentioned social enterprise. A lot of talk has gone on about replacing public provision with social enterprise, but when it's come to it, they have awarded the contracts to profit-making companies, partly because they are their people, partly because the profit-making companies undercut any rate offered by social enterprise. So I think we have to be very, very careful when we use the language of reform and not confuse a genuine attempt to make public services better, more friendly to those who use them, from an excuse to get rid of public provision and replace it, if at all, with profit-seeking companies.
And Polly, Iraq and
I think it has peculiar scars. In a sense, with one bound, Ed Miliband was free. He wasn't here, he wasn't in the country, let alone being an MP, he didn't vote for it. And one of the first things he could say on becoming leader was, I think it was a mistake. That liberated them and all of the class of 2,000 people like Chakramuna and Rachel Reeves and lots of people who just weren't there. I think he followed that up with an extraordinary thing that, you know, it's very hard to think of a leader of the opposition prevented us going to war in Syria, prevented us bombing Syria. And imagine if we had, you know, a year later, we would be bombing the other side. It would have been an act of total, utter insanity. He rescued Cameron from what would have been deep trouble, I think. So that I don't think for this generation of Labour it's too much of an issue. I think it's a real issue in their dealing and how to think about Blair. And that's difficult. You know, their most successful leader ever. And, you know, boy, do they often wish they had some of what Blair had. And they could do with some of it. So it's, you know, I'm not somebody who's going to say everything about Blair was all a total disaster and an awful mistake. But, you know, Blair and still Chilcot unresolved just remains sitting there as a dreadful reminder of the worst thing that Labour did when it was in power. But I don't think it really inhibits the present generation so much, except just when they think about him and how to cope with all of that. I think, you know, it's much more of a problem about, are we pretending to be Austerians when we're not really, in which case we frighten off our own people, or are we sort of closer to the Greens where we kind of like to be, but on the other hand, we're very frightened of alienating all those people who say we should be on the middle ground. I think it's those dilemmas are much more important than Iraq.
Right, thank you. We're almost out of time. I just wanted to end with a bit of fun. I stress this is a bit of fun. You've done this book now at the end of each parliament, I think since 97. And I assume you're going to do one at the end of the next parliament. Now, this is just... I know you've only just finished this one. Who do you think you will be writing about? Now, Polly, I know you said in one of your earlier answers that you thought Labour would just be ahead of the Tories, but that doesn't necessarily answer the question. Do you sense, therefore, you'll be writing in 5 years' time about a Lab-Lib coalition, a minority Labour government? What, say, just a bit of fun that won't be quoted against you on May the 5th or whenever. Who will you be writing about in 5 years' time? Whose policies?
I think it'll be Lib-Lab with a fair amount of support of SNP, but not in formal coalition.
But a Lib-Lab coalition.
I think a Lib-Lab coalition, or near as damn it. There may be something slightly in between where there's a sort of contract on certain things. A lot of people in Labour will say never, you know, but what we've seen about the Liberal Democrats is how plastic they are, how malleable, how easy they are to work with.
with Nick Clegg as Deputy Prime Minister?
Assuming he holds his seat, which he probably will, because if there are quite a lot of them, and I think it does look increasingly as if really rather more of, you know, they're not going to be reduced to a rump of six or ten. I suppose so, unless he decides that he wants to go off and, you know, do some other job somewhere else. I think it would be embarrassing for him and difficult. I think Labour would hate it, but they're not really in a position to dictate who is the leader of another party, and they shouldn't fool themselves that they would be in a position to do that.
David, have you got any sense of the government you'll be analysing?
My crystal ball is as muddy as yours. My gut instinct tells me, although we have a fixed-term Parliament Act, which says that it makes it very difficult for parliaments to dissolve, I predict, Mystic Meg, that there will be at least two prime ministers of this country between 2015 and 2020, and possibly three. I think we are entering unparalleled volatility in terms of the composition and the attitudes of members of the House of Commons, such that party activity will be possibly of a frenetic kind, and parties will possibly fracture, depending on all sorts of circumstances. So my prediction is, if we did write this fabled book...
If it's three prime ministers, that's three books you've got to write. The
but they'll be short ones. Go on, you have to join
in. I think it will be a minority government, not a coalition. And if the polls are right now, it will be a minority Labour government, but there will have to be a second election. But that doesn't necessarily mean three prime ministers. It could be the same prime minister. Anyway, we've come to the end of our evening together. I'd like to thank Polly and David and all of you. Thank you very much.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.